This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we examine the origins and fallout from an aborted attempt to return Rohingya refugees to Burma, also known as Myanmar. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. A scorched earth campaign that began in August 2017, conducted by Myanmar's military, drove out more than 700,000 Rohingya, a persecuted Muslim minority group who have lived in Myanmar for several generations. The Myanmar government says that any violence last year in Rakhine State was related to so-called clearance operations against Rohingya insurgents who launched coordinated attacks on police posts at an army base in August of last year. However, a recent landmark UN report concluded that the military acted with, quote, genocidal intent against Rohingya, citing numerous atrocities such as extrajudicial killings, gang rapes, and the torching of entire villages. The report provides the most detailed and haunting look yet at the massacres and other actions taken against Rohingya, which left 10,000 people dead and drove some 700,000 into neighboring Bangladesh. The report called for the leaders of Myanmar's military to be prosecuted for genocide. Fast forward to today, the repatriation of some 2,000 Rohingya refugees was scheduled to begin November 15th. However, apart from the Myanmar and Bangladesh governments, few were in favor of this move. A coalition of 42 humanitarian and civil society groups deemed the repatriation process, quote, dangerous and premature. Moreover, the Rohingya Muslims have complained about being isolated from decisions about their fates. So, when, if ever, will the Rohingya be able to return to Myanmar? And how can they return to a country which considers them to be economic migrants from Bangladesh and has never granted them citizenship, even though most can show their families have been in the country for generations? Well, joining us to analyze the failure of the repatriation agreement and the fate of the Rohingya refugees are two distinguished analysts. Christina Fink is professor of international affairs in the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University, and Sarah Margon. She's Washington director at Human Rights Watch. That's a nonprofit organization that conducts research and advocacy on human rights. And both women join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Christina Fink, let me begin with you. You were here just last year talking about Rohingya. Let me ask you, why do you think this agreement to repatriate the Rohingya from Bangladesh that was actually crafted between the Bangladesh and Myanmar governments was actually signed in the first place, especially if the majority of human rights organizations warned against it and said it was premature?
Well, I think the original idea was that the Rohingya should be able to go back home. And so there needed to be a process to facilitate that. But in order for them to be able to return home and live in safety and dignity, a lot of conditions in the country needed to be met. That included providing security in the places that they would return to, allowing people to return to their own homes, which the government does not want to allow. The government wants them to go first to temporary resettlement centers and then to go to new permanent housing, which is not in their original communities. That means that not only are they losing their former homes, but also the land that they farmed, and therefore they have no prospects for livelihoods. Other conditions that haven't been met are the right to citizenship, which is something that many refugees have said they will not go back unless they are assured that they will be able to obtain citizenship. And also freedom of movement and ability to access basic services like health and education.
Turning to you, Sarah Margon, so if most of these conditions, if not all of them, have not really been met to receive the Rohingya back into Burma, also known as Myanmar, then why was this agreement struck between Bangladesh and Myanmar? And we're seeing now that this repatriation is not going forward.
So I think if you talk to a lot of the Rohingya refugees, as many of our researchers have done, they will say that they do want to go home, that they want to return to the land that they had to flee. But as Christina says, there is no improvement in Rakhine, and certainly we've seen no improvement in northern Rakhine, where about 150,000 people are still living. And so you have to think of the other conditions. They are not living in very good conditions in Bangladesh, and it is a very large number. You have 700,000 there now. You also have refugees that have come from previous attacks from Rakhine State. Bangladesh is not a rich country. They have a lot of their own issues. And so there have been a lot of questions about how they can handle this influx of people over the long term. And so I think part of the rush to the repatriation agreement was, in fact, pressure to figure out how to manage this large population.
Very good point. So we're talking about problems in Bangladesh itself and their inability to sustain the population.
Yes, and there's an election coming up in Bangladesh in December. And so this issue has become an election issue, which is why the current government is really pushing the repatriation effort right now to show that they are dealing with this problem, that this population is not going to be in the country in the long term, because they're worried that it's going to affect their election prospects.
And Sarah Morgan, we're hearing reports also that there are allegations of sporadic beatings and intimidation by Bangladeshi soldiers toward the Rohingya refugees. So they're sort of caught between the proverbial rock and a hard place, these refugees, not being treated well in Bangladesh and not welcome yet back in Myanmar.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Bangladeshis have been very welcoming in the large sense to, you know, they had about 200,000 Rohingya refugees there already. They had about 730 come since August 25th, 2017. That's a very large population in a part of the country that is already lacking access to basic services, not very economically functional, not necessarily the best place for these refugees to be in terms of infrastructure and access to all those services that we've talked about. And so I think the real question is, how and where can these people, these Rohingya refugees that have suffered so much, return home in a way that allows them to have not just the dignity and the security, but the sustainability that they really deserve to live the lives that at this point have been stolen from them. There are, of course, tensions on the local level with the Bangladeshis that live in the area, and humanitarian groups are trying to be sensitive to that. But the camps have been set up in such a rushed way, and there's a lack of access in general to the basic services now.
So for the time being, this repatriation program is on hold, would you say, Christina?
That's correct. And I think, you know, the reality is the Myanmar government does not want them to come back. And so it is helpful from their perspective that the refugees have said, we're not going back. We're not going back if conditions aren't secure. And then it puts the government of Myanmar in the position of being able to say, well, we're ready to have you. If you don't want to come back, that's your choice. Because in fact, the population as a whole in Myanmar sees the Rohingya as terrorists. This is their perception because of the way that the military and other ultranationalist groups have portrayed the Rohingya in the media. And therefore, very few people would like to see the Rohingya come back.
You hit the nail on the head in a sense, because I wanted to talk about the historical roots of this crisis, because the Rohingya have been mistreated for decades. And this is just the latest iteration of that. So back to the historical roots of this crisis, the previous attacks on the Rohingya in Burma.
So in Myanmar, there has long been a fear of outsiders and foreign domination, and the military throughout the period of military rule, which was from 1962 until 2010, used this fear of foreigners, and particularly Muslims, South Asians, and the Rohingya population, as a way to make people feel that the military was needed as their guardian to provide for their security. So it was a way to boost the legitimacy of the military. And so what we saw in the last few years was just a new iteration of what we've seen in the past, which is that the military first accuses the Muslim population, in this case, the Rohingya Muslim population, of being a threat, and then is able to persuade people through state media and today through Facebook. And then when they carry out a military operation against this population, they can do so with the support of the public. And that's why today, even though the international community is horrified by the human rights abuses that took place, and as you said, the UN has accused the military of having genocidal intent, the military itself has a lot of support from the population in the country.
And this is also a reflection of sort of Buddhist nationalism.
It is a reflection of Buddhist nationalism. One of the arguments is that Buddhism as a religion in Myanmar is under threat, that the intention of Muslims in the country is to turn Myanmar into a Muslim country. Now, from the outside, that looks ridiculous because the Muslim population in the country is around 5%. Over 90% of the people in Myanmar are Buddhist. But people have found this to be a very emotive issue. And so without being able to really analyze it objectively, they've been taken in by that. But I want to emphasize that the military really bears a lot of responsibility for the understanding of this population as a threat. And the military has been using Facebook to put out propaganda through fake and real accounts in order to really convince the population that this population is a threat. And the military has also been supporting those Buddhist ultranationalist monks who've been putting out this propaganda.
So, Sarah Morgan, you have your finger on the pulse of the Rohingya population and its history in Burma. How do you see these latest atrocities and abuses and any prospects for ending, given the historical roots and this deep discrimination and prejudice that we're seeing in the country, underscored by the military's actions of late?
I think it's really important to remember that even though the world has been captured by what happened to the Rohingya last August, this type of military behavior has been going on for decades, and not just against the Rohingya. It's been going on against any number of ethnic groups across the country. But in some sense, it's easier for the Tatmadaw, as the military is often called, to go against the Rohingya for a couple of reasons. One, because of this widespread discrimination that they have played a very big role in perpetuating over years, because of a growing Buddhist nationalism throughout the country, and also in some sense because the Rohingya are much less well organized than some of the other ethnic groups that have very strong and well-funded ethnic armies that have been able to fight back very actively against the military. Now, that doesn't excuse in any way the fact that the Tatmadaw has basically linked the Rohingya civilians to a few individuals who sought to attack the Tatmadaw, the military and police bases. But what it does do is enables them to perpetuate this narrative that they were attacked and they need to fight back against this population, not just a few individuals. And so it allows them to undertake, in their minds, this kind of abusive action. But I think, you know, it's really important to note that the Rohingya have always been seen as an other. And there is very little chance that they will ever be seen as anything else, not just because the military has basically whitewashed the supposed investigations they've done into what happened, but because the quasi-civilian leadership end of the government has also whitewashed it. For a while, I think the international community hoped that the National League of Democracy, the NLD, and Aung San Suu Kyi would help move this in the right direction. And that hasn't happened either. So while they haven't been the ones operationalizing this plan, they have done nothing to help uncover and hold to account the individuals that have committed these atrocities.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Christina Fink, she's professor of international affairs at George Washington University, and Sarah Morgan, from whom you just heard. She's Washington director of Human Rights Watch, and we're discussing the failure and implications of the Rohingya repatriation agreement between Myanmar and Bangladesh. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. And you can also find the download on iTunes at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Ankit Kumar Barwal from New Delhi. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Christina Fink, to talk more about accountability, if the military will ever be held accountable. And what about the role of Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi? She's the putative leader of Myanmar, and yet she's been criticized for not doing enough to use her leverage with the military. Does she even have any leverage? You know, how do you see her role in all of this? And could she, if she wanted to, exert greater influence?
Yes, that's a very good question. The 2008 constitution, which set up the form of government that is in place in Myanmar today, separates the roles of the military and the civilian government and gives the military full autonomy over its actions. So Aung San Suu Kyi had no power to stop how the military behaved in Rakhine State, and she can't punish them for their deeds either. That said, she can certainly influence the tone of the national conversation on this issue, and she is seen as a moral leader in the country. She can advocate for a more inclusive, diverse society where the rights of everybody are respected, and that is something she has failed to do. Instead, what she has done is said that she believes the military. If the military says they didn't commit human rights abuses, then they didn't commit human rights abuses. If the international community is saying that they committed human rights abuses, well, they don't know the country. Only Burmese people understand the country, and therefore their narratives can't be taken at face value. So that's a real failure on her part. And what is happening on the ground is that the two communities, the Rohingya community and the ethnic Rakhine Buddhist communities, which although there was discrimination, it's also true that in many places they did live together. And there were people who went to school together, people who worked together. There was integration between some of these communities. But that now has been ended. And what's happening to Rohingya populations that remain in Rakhine State or that are supposed to go back to Rakhine State is that they will be segregated from those ethnic Rakhine communities. And that is a really negative way to go forward because it means that these two populations will find it much more difficult to come together in the future.
Well, Sarah Maragon, we also note that U.S. Vice President Mike Pence was recently in the region and he met with Aung San Suu Kyi. And he told her that the violence against the Rohingya Muslims in her country was without excuse. To what extent did that message get through? And why is she in denial of the well-documented atrocities against the Rohingya at the hands of the Myanmar military?
It is a good question because it seems pretty clear she's getting the information. And while she may be dismissing it out of hand, she's also hindering efforts to ensure that information is out there. She is really the one, the ministries that fall under her leadership were the ones that denied the UN investigators from getting into the country. Now, they may not have actually been able to get up to northern Rakhine had they been allowed into Burma because the military would have tightly controlled that, but she wouldn't even let them into the country. And so there is both a denial and an obfuscation of what is happening on her part, which leads me to believe that she does know what's going on, but doesn't know how to deal with it, is concerned about the upcoming election in Burma and how that will reflect on her and her ability to lead. She doesn't want the military to again gain enough rule and power to be completely in charge. So I think that is probably on the horizon, and that is understandable. But again, I think the question of Aung San Suu Kyi as the moral leader is an important one. And there was such great hope, such high expectations that she would help move not just Burma in the right direction and help build the institutions that Burma so desperately needed to build, but that she would help move the population to a place where they could be more tolerant and inclusive after years and years of pretty heavy-handed repression. And she has really failed on all accounts. And to watch Burma backtrack from the little progress that it had made after 2008 is very disheartening to see. That means that the next step is to rely on international actors to raise concerns. And so on the one hand, I think it's great that Vice President Pence sat down and raised that directly with her. Frankly, it's long overdue. The president has not mentioned Rohingya one time since the crisis started. The State Department has been more vocal. They have been more forward-leaning. Congress certainly has been. So it's great that the vice president sat down and raised it directly with her. On the other hand, it's hard for me to believe that she'll take him seriously because of things that are happening here in the United States that the White House has encouraged, including a lot of violence against various minorities in this country. And so, yes, he should have raised it, but he should also be aware that his message may only go so far.
Well, speaking of that, Christina, U.S. policy, to what extent the United States has any leverage with Burma, with Aung San Suu Kyi at this point? Sarah referenced a report. The U.S. State Department issued a report, at least key bureaus in the State Department, condemning the violence by the Myanmar military acknowledging crimes against humanity, but nothing came of it so far. The United States has been struggling to define its position and decide on action. What is holding Washington back, in your view, and how much influence could it exert if it were to move forward more aggressively?
Well, the Trump administration has really turned away from Asia as a whole. And if you look at the last ASEAN meeting, the meeting of Southeast Asian nations, the president didn't go, but Xi Jinping from China was there and ready to capitalize on the moment. And I think that's a really important thing for our government to look at, is the way that China is taking advantage of this situation and presenting itself as the ally to Myanmar in its moment of crisis that can be counted on. So we see China actually just signing these huge economic deals with the Myanmar government. One is going to create a corridor from southern China down to Rakhine State with a railroad and roads that will facilitate the transportation of goods. And another project is a deep sea port also in Rakhine State, which had been brought up before but was just passed in the last month. And so you see China really being able to capitalize on this moment when the U.S. and the government in Myanmar are kind of at odds, even though the U.S. hasn't done much, because the NLD government feels like the U.S. is not on its side at this moment. The NLD government feels that it has to turn to China for support in the Security Council and elsewhere, and therefore that's facilitating China being able to push through these economic deals.
That doesn't augur well, does it, Sarah Morgan? Because we know that China is mistreating its own Muslim minority population. So in terms of doing anything to help reintegrate the Rohingya, it doesn't bode well.
No, not at all. And I think when you're thinking about why the MOU got signed last June, I think it's hard to believe that there wasn't some measure of pressure from the Chinese to start moving this process forward, even though the MOU that was signed was really in contravention to international standards. UNHCR wasn't adequately involved in the process, and the Rohingya themselves were not sufficiently involved in the process. They've been very clear on what they want and need in order to return. And while the Bangladeshis have been very good at receiving them and trying to support them, there has been less effort in helping them get what they need to return home. And that's not going to happen overnight. But when you have the Chinese supporting the Burmese government now with all these economic and infrastructure projects, it seems unlikely that it's going to happen at all.
This is very disheartening, Christina Fink. So we're sort of back to where we began, which is with this aborted repatriation attempt, with the Rohingya not being sufficiently well treated in Bangladesh, which has been an important haven for them in this interim, and not being able to return to their native land. Where do we go from here, in your view, and who has leverage over their fate?
You know, honestly, I think it's very important for countries to begin looking at moving the Rohingya to other countries where they can obtain citizenship and live decent lives. And yes, it's a huge population. We're talking about over 700,000 people. But if these people could be integrated into other countries, in not just the traditional resettlement countries in the West, but also Muslim majority countries in the Mideast, where you already have Rohingya refugee populations, then I think that this would be a better way forward for many of the Rohingya. And then perhaps if the number of refugees in Bangladesh were reduced, if there were sufficient support from the international community, maybe Bangladesh would be willing to integrate some of that population into Bangladesh itself, because I just don't see the possibility of them being able to go home and live safe, dignified, sustainable lives anytime soon.
Sarah Morgan.
Part of this process of how to support and provide a home for the Rohingya refugees has to be accountability, that they have to be able to go somewhere they feel safe. And if the international community is not able to show accountability for the Burmese military and what they did, I think that cuts off the likelihood that they will ever consider going home.
On that note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Christina Fink, she's professor of international affairs at George Washington University, and Sarah Morgan, Washington director at Human Rights Watch. Encounter was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.